It's about 3 minutes before 10:30 at WBAU 90.3 FM in Garden City, New York, and Roscoe has arrived.
Wow. You know, I'm so, I'm knocked out tonight. I mean, like, really, really knocked out. And, I mean, you know why, for, like, personal reasons and all that, you know. Seeing you at the party. What party was that?
Oh, the Rick Wakeman.
That's right, that's right. And, you know, like, wow, all the time that's passed. And I know I'm speaking disjointedly, so to speak, but...
Yeah.
Can I just explain for a moment that Ellen and I have been friends for a long time, and I'm so nervous. I haven't seen her in a few years, and to be sitting here as a guest on her program, I mean, like, I just don't believe it, you know.
I don't believe this either.
We're going to sit here and just, you know, right.
Oh, it was absolutely amazing, because about a Monday before last, my sister and I went to see Rick Wakeman at the Garden, and at the reception, I was walking along, and all of a sudden, I see this face I had not seen in 4 years.
And she screamed, ah!
I said, oh my God,
at the face.
This person I had, you know, my sister and I had been looking for so long, and here he was, and I was thinking of all these ways to contact you at QIV, and it wasn't on the air, and where could I find you? And see, we had switched addresses and everything, and Roscoe had gone to France, and we had no way to get in touch with him, and we said, oh, we'll never see him again. And
no way.
You were just there, you know.
Yeah, I did. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, so many things have happened, and they seem to have happened in 5 minutes. It doesn't seem like, you know, it's been like 3-4 years. You know?
Yeah.
It seems like it's been like, oh, and seeing or listening to or hearing the changes and feeling the changes over here now is, I think, the greatest gift I've received in my life from life itself. You know, having gone away and been able to look at everything in this society with an objective point of view. Oh, I mean, we need that more than anything else,
yeah.
You know. And I must have gone away subconsciously to get that, you know, because I felt that I wasn't producing,
mm-hmm.
You know, that I had lost contact with myself, yeah, as a person. And if no one knew it, it was only because I was a little bit, slicker than someone else in being able to hide it. But
yeah.
I couldn't hide it from myself, you know. And that's what I discovered most of all, that I needed objectivity. Well, in order to get that, I would have to, examine myself first, you know. And then I think you're able to look at and see other things. And then discovering, since I've returned, I have a buddy, Alan Perver, who happens to have been born in England, right? So, like, he and I discussed the two different societies, the two different worlds, you know. And exchange and share, you know, information and feelings about them, you know. I mention Alan because with that objectivity that he has about our society, you know, which is really his society now, you know, he's able to see things that we can't see. And one evening he said, hey, you've got to go with me to the Hotel Diplomat and, you know, see some groups. And... very frankly, I had in mind groups,
yeah.
You know, period, you know. And when we arrived, one group after another, we saw four groups at this place, and one group after another, they sounded orchestral. And I don't think any group was, you know, numbered more than maybe 6 or 7 members. But the guys had mastered their instruments, and they were confident now. And where they were weak down the middle, you know, and rhythm and everything, all that's together now, the heartbeat, you know. And to sit there and look at that growth was amazing. Again, it was a gift to me, you know, to see that. And from that point of view, and I kept asking Alan, I said, man, you mean they're not known? You know, they're not recorded or what? He says, they're not played. They're not played on the air. You don't hear them,
that's
you know.
That's the whole thing.
See, yes. And I think that in many areas of radio here, since I've been back, and just listening, it seems like they become insulated,
mm-hmm.
You know. And once that stops, once that stops, the development of artist, the development of the feeling of the society and all that stops, the line of communication stops, you know, and the society becomes insulated. And we are, in a sense, an insulated society now as a result of that, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you were saying the thing about they're not played, the good thing about this station and a lot of college stations in the area that a lot of big people, quote-unquote, don't seem to want to take advantage of is that we can play anything that, you know, is not unairable because of curse words or whatever, but right. We can play these unknown groups, and we do. And, in fact, for the past 3 years or whatever that I've been here, that's a whole high point of my show. What I like to do is spotlight new talent and give some time. And, in fact, in the past year, I've had people from the area, just guys who have a guitar, who have music that they've recorded, demos and things, and I make sure that they copyright everything before they play it here, just for their own protection. Then they come up and they play for an hour or so. But as you were saying, I don't know what's been happening since you came back.
Everything really. I mean, it's like being a stranger in my own hometown.
Yes.
Yeah, it really is. Oh yes, and to feel in a way, you know, that to be so presumptuous as to think that you can offer something now, you know, that's a good thing. That's a good feeling. To feel that you've gone away and you've learned something and you can, you know, present it.
Mm-hmm.
See? I became sick of you want to take a mind excursion.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Right. That's right. That's right. And you know, it sort of it wore itself, and nothing was happening. You know, with that, it didn't move me anymore.
No, it was also amazing. After you had left, we used to listen to CBS, and we heard all those, you know, tapes and things that you had done, and. We used to listen late at night to them. And one of the ones you had done, I'll never forget, right after Jim Morrison had died, and you had gone to France at almost the same time that had happened. And that whole scene really freaked my sister and I out with him, you know, because like, Linda really thought he was one of the greatest poets and everything. And the thing was, the night that happened, and you had no way of knowing, because this was a taped show.
Right.
You play the Doors and would talk, and you usually, even if you had just played them, you might just say it was them. And you were talking about them, and you had played L.A. Woman, and it was like so amazing because she was sitting there listening, and we said it's like something like a Sixth Sense type thing.
Isn't that amazing? Because those shows are taped four weeks or something like that in advance. Mm-hmm. They were, yeah. That's amazing to hear. I didn't know that. Because I know his death came as a shock to me.
Oh, yeah.
And I hadn't seen him over there. I had only heard, when I heard of his death, I thought he had died in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know he had even lived in Paris.
Yeah, the whole thing was so strange because here it was, you were there when it happened, right? And your voice was here and you were talking about him, and it was just like really amazing for me.
Yeah, I remember them when they were at Ondine's when they first started.
Yeah.
And even Light My Fire wasn't really put together. It was a part of the repertoire, but they hadn't really put it together. And it was developing then. And I was happy one time by one promoter, I forget his name, I was asked to do a show at the Village Theater, and the Doors were on that bill. And then I could really see then that, well, they had, you know, bam, they had made it, you know, so fast. And it was great to watch the development of that. Now you can see that today. You can see that same thing developing.
Yeah.
And, you know, the musicians with a different attitude in some cases, you know. Mm-hmm. I think Clapton did what a lot of other people did, too. He went away and he sort of got himself together, you know, as a person. It seems like you have to go through that every 3 or 4 years, you know, because you lose contact with yourself. At least those with whom I speak, you know, they say you know, the same thing.
That's what I want to do when I get out of college. Go away and lose track for a while.
Right. Well, what fascinates me so much is the anxiety to get that station, you know, going, to work with it. And I know you want to ask, when is it going on?
No,
right?
I was going to say, when you called before, I was so excited because you said you might be going on tonight.
Yeah.
And what happened?
I was too. As a matter of fact, we were at a meeting, and the general manager said at that moment we're expecting a call from Washington, you know, and giving a decision. And in the midst of that meeting, he received the phone call, and there was simply no decision. And he was totally frustrated.
Yeah.
I had gone through it once before, a couple of times before at stations. And, you know, and I keep myself busy during the day, and it doesn't affect me in that way because I'm positive that it's going through. Because it is the same owner, mm-hmm. you know. And it's just a matter of time. And then you become sensitive to the changeover, the people involved in it. I was going to a concert a few nights ago and at Avery Fisher Hall, and we were so hepped up about, you know, anxious to get on the air and everything. And so Alan, my wife, and his girlfriend and I were going to see Weather Report. And as we approached the... As we approached the, you know, the front of the hall, a young lady runs up and she says, "Will you sign this petition? You know, we're trying to save WNCN."
Oh, good.
They just wanted to, fill a vacuum. It seems like management wants to fill a vacuum in, New York radio.
Uh-huh. Oh, and, there definitely is one there.
I love the call letters because it reminds me of the period of stereo, right? Mm-hmm. And then quad four, because that will be that's such a great sound, because you hear everything, you're surrounded, mm-hmm. you know, really surrounded with music.
Yeah, I've never really experienced quadraphonic radio or...
I hadn't music. until we went through a dry run at the station. I'd only heard the theory of it, you know, and which meant to me just simply four speakers. Mm-hmm. But there is something technical involved in it, and it does make you feel like, I mean, it's just actually surrounding you.
Yeah,
it's a great. It'll, I think, revolutionize the industry mm-hmm. to a great extent. Just the stereo there.
Well, it's just such a great idea because I don't know, the radio, FM radio in New York, commercial wise, is so bad now.
Yes, and you know, everyone really, you know, we blame it on the commercial. It's not the commercial. It's
no,
the control
I don't mean
at the radio station. You know what I mean?
Not these. I'm trying to differentiate between educational and commercial.
Yeah.
Whereas it's not the commercials themselves, but it's just, like you said, the whole organization.
Yeah, the control. They become, they stop growing, actually. I mean, that's what happens. They stop growing. They it's why a father loses contact with his child, because he stops growing. And why friendships deteriorate, because the friendships don't grow. Why relationships deteriorate. Mm-hmm. Because there has to be growth. I spoke with station owners since I've returned, station managers, and invariably they would always say, when they felt that their station was slipping, they would say, I'm going to change personnel, you know, we're going to change disc jockeys. And invariably I would have to say to them that, you know, change yourself. Because if you don't grow, nothing around you is going to grow. Mm-hmm. And especially they're in control of it.
Yeah, a lot of times they disassociate themselves completely from what's going on the air because they don't feel like they can be part of it. But
right, that's right. It's funny how they change. They forget who a Jethro Tull is. You know, they have no concept. They have no understanding as to he along with other artists contribute to the success of that radio station. You see, and that station manager doesn't know him. You know, hasn't even been to a concert. He doesn't hear the language, you know, expressed about him. Nothing. I mean, to say nothing of David Bowie, as obvious as he is.
Yeah.
You see, most station managers, you know, don't know him. They don't know McLaughlin or what he's trying to do.
Yeah.
They don't know Claude Angel. They, you know, they become insulated themselves. So they think what is happening on the air is really right. Or, excuse me, they look at the rating sheet and they say, well, we're not so bad off, you know, and so forth. And they adjust it instead of just looking for the truth and saying, man, I have to find out what's happening,
yeah.
you know, and because I'm narrow. So I have to find it out from someone else or, you know, from the people themselves. So that's what it amounts to.
Like
the reason I don't give have interviews in the show.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a secret. I rationalized it, right?
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, I'm really scared to all the technical things involved, right?
Yeah,
plus,
yeah.
What to ask the guest? You know, I don't know. I wouldn't even know what to ask him, right? And to stand firm on that, every station I'd work they would say, you got to do an interview. I said, look, I said, when you're building a mood, you know, and music and so forth, you can't have it interrupted, you know, by, you know, an interview. Well, the truth is, you know, I was really, I wouldn't even know what to ask someone. You know, how do you feel? You understand?
Yeah, hi, how are you? I sit here sometimes and I laugh because I go to do interviews with people, and half the times they're all, I think the best ones are, give or take a few, are spontaneous ones. But I remember we had Harry Chapin up here once, and it was the funniest interview I ever did because I'm not particularly thrilled with his music. I like it, but I don't love it. So when they found out, I was subbing for someone at the station that night, and the guy that was usually on could have, you know, done it better with him because he liked him.
Yes.
And they found out I was at the helm, and they almost died. They said, why is she doing the show? So he came in, and what happened was we said, hi, Harry. And he said, hi, Ellen. And I said, how are you, Harry? I did this on purpose. And he said, I'm fine. And you, Ellen? I said, great. And I said, you just did a show downstairs, didn't you? And he said, yeah. He goes, how was it? Really good. And it went back and forth like that. And then finally I started laughing. I said, this is, you know, just what I wanted to show people can happen. You know. And then we started talking. He asked me questions about my life. He said, everyone always asks me questions. Why don't you talk about your life and what it's like being a disc jockey? And the program director has gone crazy. He goes, I don't want to hear about her. I want to hear about him.
That's right.
I said, Harry, I'm glad you asked me that. No one ever asked the DJ. Why don't we talk about that? And then I said, well, one of the good things about doing radio, having that mass audience out there and not having to face them, is the fact that we can make jokes just as trivial as we are right here now and not have the audience groaning
with us
realizing it. So we could sit there and make all the jokes in the world we want to, and we'd never know.
You can't hear them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. Yeah.
But it was funny. That was a good one.
To let you know indirectly.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take this call before we all go crazy. Okay?
You know.